with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And the bagpipes remind me that today is the Gathering of the Clans. Today and tomorrow, the Gathering of the Clans in Salado. Presuming that you're listening to this on Saturday, November the 8th, at some point we may rerun this show, so this is not a show.
One of the benefits of the Gathering of the Clans in Salado versus the historic Gathering of the Clans is that there tends to be a lot less killing going on at the Salado Gathering of the Clans.
That's right.
They get together and they eat and they wander around and they talk to each other and they smile a lot instead of stabbing each other with pointy metal objects.
Or poisoning each other or killing each other in their sleep.
Right.
Kind of a great tradition. The Campbells were particularly notable for when they hosted the Gathering of the Clans. Generally, one clan emerged alive and the rest of them were
dead. So they would poison them or kill them in their sleep, which is why they make such good soup.
I'm working
Campbell's soup.
Campbell's soup has something to do with killing people in their sleep.
Poison, I mean, you know, if you want the poison to be undetectable, you just make the soup really good. So they just stopped putting poison in it, and they realized they could make money. It's amazing.
Oh, well, that's cool. I like that. Sounds
hey, we don't have to kill people. Let's make money.
Distinct advantage over some alternatives.
I'm going to stop killing people and invent capitalism, said Adam Smith.
That doesn't sound to me very much like a Scottish name.
Well, he did it in Scotland, so I mean.
But he was Scots.
And he was a Smith, or his family was a Smith. So
something like that. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to call in, and so far we've had exactly a round number of callers today.
Very round. The roundest of numbers.
The most round of numbers, yes. Is it roundest or most round? I don't know.
You may have to look that up.
Yes.
Maybe someone can call in and tell us whether zero is the most round or roundest of numbers.
I think that's interesting. Anyway, 773-1400 is the number to call in East Bell County.
Otherwise, you can reach us at a toll-free number of 1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
And there's some other news that happened during the week.
Oh, man, I thought we were just going to do the quiet game all hour.
That'd be cool. Two different court decisions regarding bondholders.
And another one regarding Obamacare.
Did they actually have a decision regarding?
They decided to decide on it.
Oh, well, but they didn't actually decide what they were going to decide.
No, that's most of the court is really about deciding whether or not they're going to decide.
Well,
they have an ETA on whether or not they'll have an ETA.
Both in Stockton, California, and in Detroit, Michigan, court decisions were handed down that stated that bondholders are getting the short end of the stick when compared with pension fund recipients. And that's different because historically, municipal bondholders have had first place when a municipality collapses, goes bankrupt, becomes insolvent.
They're the ones that came up with the money to fund what was happening there to begin with.
But in this case, the courts have determined that the law protects the pension recipients more than it protects the bondholders, so the bondholders are going to get back a significant less amount of money than they otherwise would have. And this is the funny thing. When people purchase the bonds for Stockton and for Detroit, they were generally AA or AAA rated at the time. And now they are experiencing a significant loss on the principle of those bonds.
What this is going to do, it has some long-term implications to the municipals market. It has a long-term implications for municipalities in general. Before, when people invested in municipal bonds, they said, I'm making a loan to a governmental entity that has the power to raise its taxes to pay my bond back. This is a very low-risk situation. Not only that, the courts in the past had always ruled that they were number one priority in paying back the debt. What that means with this new decision of, one, you're not number one priority in paying it back. Two, sometimes the taxes don't get raised to obscene levels to pay you back. Means that it's going to be harder for cities and districts and water utilities and so on to get bonds. It's going to get harder for them to get money from the public because the risk just went up. And one of the benefits to municipal bonds in many cases is they weren't federally taxed on the income. But if your risk is actually higher, then the interest rate is going to have to come up, and it's going to be more expensive for the municipalities. And that means that they're going to have to raise their taxes, which means if you own property, you're going to be paying for this.
And if historically people thought municipal bonds were the safest of the safe things, and if they were AAA rated insured, people bought them. And now some of the people who bought them are learning the hard way that, the, first off, the insurance companies are bankrupt.
Right.
And so they're not going to pay for it. And the municipalities are bankrupt. And
they're not going to pay for it.
They're not going to pay for it. So when is the next round of this likely to happen? It's going to be a bit sooner than you might think, in my opinion, for two reasons. One, interest rates are going up.
Yep.
Probably 2015, maybe 2016, more likely 2015, and the markets are indicating, and this is people who read the tea leaves in the markets, sometime around the fall of next year, we're going to see the Fed start to raise interest rates and interest rates start up. I think that's a pretty reasonable time.
And unless we see some drastic growth in the near future, I think that's
or collapse.
I think that's a reasonable expectation.
So, when interest rates start up, it's going to have a negative effect on municipal bonds for a host of reasons. But the key is that, first off, the interest rates going up are going to have a negative effect. And secondly, the fact that there is a much higher risk in them today than there used to be is going to have a negative effect. So it's one of those things where at one time I think people were fairly comfortable with the idea that they could just buy a municipal bond and forget about it.
Ross Perot was pretty famous for that, where he just basically put all of his several billions of dollars in a municipal bond portfolio and got paid tax-free and didn't have to worry about anything. Well, that's not the case anymore.
And that's just one of those things that to bear in mind, that a lot of things that we once thought were sacrosanct aren't. And there's another thing that went on this week that I thought was pretty cool, although it's definitely painful for some people. Crude oil prices have now fallen 25% in 4 months, and they hit a three-year low of $77.19 a barrel on Tuesday.
Yeah, they're at 78.43
Well, 78.65 it says here on Friday, but never mind. It's
how crude is your reading? Mine says crude on it, so
it's a very crude
reading.
Crude. This is New York Mercantile Exchange.
Well, that's a crude reading, too. That's just the problem there. Crude readings.
This is the point. Below $80 a barrel, there are some interesting things start to happen around the world, including the fact that Venezuela starts coasting towards
bankruptcy
at a higher rate of speed.
Yeah, at a higher. It was already heading there very quickly. It just went into acceleration.
And that means that the airlines will be paying a lot less to fly people around.
That's going to have a lag effect because they have been buying long-term contracts, 3 to 6 month contracts on their oil. And right now they're wishing that they hadn't, but most of them have done it. It's one of the reasons why Southwest was able to keep their prices so low for so long is they bought a two-year contract several years back, and they locked it in at that two-year for that two-year at a lower rate, and the others didn't, and they were very upset. And
But among the massive world-shaking economic effects notable in this price is the fact that when oil was rising in value 7 years ago, on this show we said that about $85 a barrel was about the right price for oil,
and it probably
went up to 100.
And we went, whoa!
And now we realize that the rise in the price of oil was an anomaly.
Yeah, and I would say the price of oil now with new technology in existence, the way we are pumping, should rest pretty nicely, right around $75 a barrel. However, we may see it get lower than that, drastically lower than that. And it won't stay there very long.
I don't know.
I don't think it will stay there very long because the production will slow way down.
It might, but here's the point that I want to make: there's been a tremendous amount of money invested in discovering and recovering new oil around the world.
Right.
And the infrastructure is there.
We've already paid, people have already paid the money to get into it.
So the infrastructure is there, and they're not going to shut off the oil running through the pipelines just because the price is low, because they still need to pay the bonds.
Yeah, they have a fixed cost already in place.
Yeah, they've borrowed the money to build pipelines and refineries and drill holes in the ground, and they may pump a little less than they might have otherwise, but they're still going to be pumping. And the last time this happened, and I'm going by history again, we tend to massively overreact to these things. Oil price was probably a fair price. It was around $40 a barrel.
Yeah.
In the 1970s, there was a lot of forecasting of it go to 100. It didn't quite get there. But it dropped to 20 and stayed there a long time. And the reason is there's a huge lag between the time when oil prices spike, as they have for the last 7 years.
These are inflation-adjusted figures for those of you that are wondering.
And when the oil prices spike, as they have for the last 7 years, inflation-adjusted figure? No, it was actually 40, then 20. It went to 20.
I realize that.
Real nominal numbers back then. I think it was up to about like $80 a barrel or $50 a barrel or something, and then it dropped back to 20 and just stayed there for a long time. And we could see, in my opinion, a drop to as low as $40 a barrel, and it sticked there for quite a long time. And the reason I say that is there's two elements to any economic equation like this. Actually, there's more than two, but there's two major elements, supply and demand. We have increased the supply dramatically, and nobody's going to shut it off. Now, Saudi Arabia certainly demonstrated the fact that...
In the 70s.
This time around, they've demonstrated the fact they're willing to open up a price war to keep their market share because they have infrastructure projects and all kinds of projects. They need the cash flow.
Yeah, let me explain that. Some people may not even be aware that it happened. During the last week, the Saudis said that they were going to give the United States buyers, and that's not the government, that's everybody in the United States that's buying from Saudi, a discount on their oil prices over what is being paid by people in other places in the world, which sounds a little bit strange. Why are they giving us a discount? Well, the reason is because our prices here are dropping so fast that we would rather buy our own oil from ourselves then go to Saudi Arabia and have it shipped across large bodies of water to our country. And the Saudis know that if they ever stop a constant stream of ships going across those large bodies of water, it's very expensive to get those ships back moving between Saudi Arabia and the United States.
That's what I'm saying. There's this huge lag because once you've got investment, and a lot of people got investment in ships.
Right.
And if the ships are just sitting there not hauling oil,
that doesn't work very well.
They deteriorate.
They lose a lot of money and then they
lose money. And so people are willing to come down to what we would consider to be money-losing prices. It's just like builders, home builders, have a tendency to build homes long after it's profitable to build homes because that's what they do. They build homes.
Right. Exactly.
And oil producers have a tendency to produce oil. By the way, it only costs the Saudis, if you say that correctly, about $10 a barrel.
$4
a barrel.
Four.
But I'm talking about it's $10 a barrel to get it out of the ground and get it to the United States.
Right. Yeah.
So anything above $10 a barrel, they make a profit.
Correct.
And as a result, they're willing to come way down, which is, by the way, the reverse of what we saw when OPEC was founded, when they were going to force the price of oil up.
This is the next point I was going to mention. There's a price war inside OPEC.
Mm-hmm.
They are fighting each other to see who can go keep their market share the best with the United States, which means they are no longer the consortium that sets the prices because they don't agree internally. It's kind of like the Republican Party. Well, you think they're going to get together and they're going to have a common platform and they're going to move with it and they're all right. No, that's not how it happens. When you win and you've been on top for a while, you start to fight with each other. And that's a sad, sad truth, but it's a truth nonetheless. It's a happy truth when it's an OPEC involved.
It will be a interesting thing to watch all this unfold at all levels. What it boils down to, though, the most significant effect of the falling price of oil, and as I said, my sense is it's got a little ways further to fall,
Yeah, I would
maybe
say
down to $40.
I would say it's going to have a pretty drastic drop for a while.
Is it puts
and it's going to hover there
a really large amount of money in the American consumer's pocket to spend.
Yeah,
and the American consumer historically has responded with a lag to a falling price of oil by buying things. There's going to be a lot of companies who make money and a lot of companies who lose money. For example, some railroads are going to lose money because the price of oil falls because they're really locked into hauling oil around.
Right.
On the other hand, the railroad companies that are not hauled in, that are not locked into hauling oil around, burn oil, and so it will cut their costs. There's a lot of things going to happen in the economy. But the net result, and that's one of the reasons I'm forecasting an increase in jobs, an increase in economic prosperity, and that by 2016 we'll have an economy that is hitting on all cylinders very solidly, which may have a political effect at that point. And here's the question. Will people credit the Republicans, because they took over Congress, or the president, as they traditionally have, for the improved economy? And I think that all boils down to whether the Republicans are busy slitting each other's throats. If the Republicans get into a food fight on Capitol Hill, which historically they have done once they get in charge without a president in the White House, then the American voting population will be disgusted with Congress. And they always give the president credit for the economy, whether he has anything to do with it or not.
Now, there is something that could happen that's the reverse of that.
What's
the
that?
Republicans could actually show some
I am hoping for that.
Some group leadership and some ability to work across the aisle. If
and
they
work
don't
between the two houses.
If they do not, if the Republicans do what they normally do when they have a majority in both houses, is they start fighting between the houses rather than working together. This is a unique point in history, and I could say that about any point in history, but it makes it sound really nice if I say it about this point in history. They have an opportunity to reach across the aisle. One of the things that we saw in this election that has been pretty quiet because of all the results that looked like massive outpourings of Republican winning is that the independents had a much larger input than they've ever had in the past. The group in the middle that isn't in the extreme right or the extreme left is getting bigger because the polarity between those two sides is getting so loud that things aren't getting done. So the center is not just making the decision on who wins anymore. It's getting big enough to make decisions whenever they want, not just at swing points. There's not a party that sits in the middle. We have two parties, and then you have this group that's growing gradually, and it's not so gradual in the last few years. There's a lot more independents than there used to be. Keep that in mind when you're looking at the next election. If the Republicans base all of their decisions in winning the House and the Senate on fighting the Democrats, then they're very, very likely to not get the presidency. If instead they woo the independents with a cause and a platform that is right for America over a long period of time, not just right for a certain small group of Americans, and they're not petty about it. We have a tendency when the majority takes over to change rules in the Senate to make it so that the majority works forever that way, and the swing back and forth. The Senate is supposed to be the house of wisdom. That's what it means. Sin means aged, means well thought. That's this, senile is actually a part of that same word, and you think about that actually makes more sense than I like to think about. If they don't start acting like a wise group of people in the Senate, and the House doesn't start acting like a forward-thinking group of people that's more interested in the welfare of the country than their own party, then they're going to lose the presidency when it comes to it. It's theirs to lose. Because with this landslide, if this had been a presidential election, there would be a Republican president. Mm-hmm. They have 2 years to lose that or to keep it.
You're right.
It's a tough one.
And it'll be really interesting. And the leaders are making the right noises. The question is whether the rank and file will fall in behind.
Right. And that's the big one, right? Since the Tea Party has had such a big influence in the Republican Party, they have been putting the brakes on actually very reasonable acts. And it's
let
not
me
good.
There's another, not record, but exceptional number that was reported with the jobs report.
Three?
Actually, no. It's 2,711,000.
Oh, well, that's a very nice number.
That is the number of federal non-military uniform-wearing employees.
Non-military uniform-wearing?
In other words, other than the people wearing uniforms, would leave out of that factor for a moment. In other words, the civilian civil servant employees in the United States of America, employed by the federal government in and out of the United States of America, 2.711 million, is the lowest number. Now, this is not adjusted for inflation or population or anything else.
I don't know. The obesity lowest, epidemic says we should adjust for inflation.
This is the lowest number of federal employees since 1966.
Wow.
It is the lowest percentage number.
And this is under a Democrat president.
Right. It is the lowest percentage number since World War II.
Probably
since
before World War II. Yeah.
Yes. So what we have is the size of the federal government as an employer is the lowest since before the Second World War. And it even, if you start looking at the government's share of the economy, the numbers start to also get interesting. The government's share of the economy is down to below 30% of GDP.
That's very nice.
And we hit 35%, to give you an example, under Ronald Reagan. We hit 35%, the government expenditures were 35% of the GDP under Ronald Reagan. They stayed up there in that vicinity until the 1990s under William Jefferson Clinton. When they dropped by about 2000, they dropped all the way down to 30%. And then they started rising under George W. Bush. And, of course, during the recession under both Bush and mainly it started under George W. Bush, and
but
then
really went into overdrive under Obama.
Obama, they jumped up to like 38%. Now they have fallen. Well, actually, they've fallen back to 34%, and
it's expected
they're
to
on
drop
the
down
way.
To 30.
They're on the way down to a 30% level as far as the government's participation in the economy. Now
let me say something here.
Yeah.
This is important. When Reagan raised spending, and he brought it way up to 35, 38, there was a cause for that, and we won the Cold War.
Well, actually, it wasn't military spending that brought it up. It was a recession of 1982. Unemployment.
Right.
Welfare.
But we didn't lower defense spending. We raised defense spending during that time period. And once again, when we're looking at George W. Bush and Barack Obama, defense and a recession are part of what happened there. We had unemployment, we had a lowering of tax revenue, and we had a lowering of the GDP, and the spending went up for stimulus and defense. So you put those together, and you can see that there's an echo there. And
sure.
No matter how much we say Democrats act differently from Republicans, when you look at history and we're looking at overall spending and we're looking at defense spending, it's not so much so. People tend to be people when it comes to the presidency.
And it's just one of the things that if you are listening to this radio program, odds are you are a Republican and a conservative because that's geographically where we are. The Republicans, and particularly conservative Republicans, are still squalling and hollering about let's lower government spending, let's have the government employing fewer people. Folks, this is the, like I said, you got to go back to the mid-1960s to find, and we're talking about the population of the United States has grown tremendously, but the federal government now employs as few people as it did in the mid-1960s. And that, by the way, is a
50
very
years ago.
strange thing. It's, by the way, during the last 2 years, the only sector in the economy that has shown shrinking employment
government
is the federal government. Now, overall.
Also local government as well.
Local government, though, has started increasing.
Correct.
Again.
Yeah.
But the bottom line to it is local governments now employ far more people, far more people than the federal government, which was the goal. And one of the things that all movements tend to do is keep on trying to move after it is no longer effective to move in that direction. There's a inertia there. It's now, very frankly, time, I think, to back off trying to shrink the federal government. And the reason I say that is in discussing some things with my more conservative friends, they are saying we need to stop the influx of people across the border. I agree completely. Okay, the unauthorized illegal influx of people across the border with Mexico.
Uh-huh.
That takes more people and more money. You can't say, let's cut the budget. And police the border. The Congress, for example, passed a bill signed by the president that said we would put a fence up all along the border.
But we didn't have the budget for it.
But the House of Representatives cut that money out of the budget.
Because they were cutting the budget.
And now they're very unhappy because people are crossing the border in mass. And as our economy improves, the temporary slack off that we have seen in illegal border crossings.
Yeah, that's going to reverse and go the other direction.
It's already going the other direction. And we just haven't seen the numbers on it yet.
Huge surge is coming.
Anecdotally, people who are down in that part of the world who come back and tell me what's going on are seeing something they haven't seen in a couple of years, which is
convoys.
Groups of 25 and better people moving through the underbrush at night. And overwhelming our ability to even come close to dealing with it. We need to take some... By the way, this is a point I agree on completely. We need a complete revamp of immigration. We have the jobs here. Well, okay, let's have guest worker permits and have them come in legally.
Let them pay taxes correctly.
Which is, by the way, the one thing the Republicans and the Democrats agree on.
What's that?
We want to leave the immigration laws exactly as they are
and not
work.
Silly. That is so silly.
Because the Republicans don't want a lot of Mexican or Hispanic people coming into the United States because they're afraid they'll become citizens or something. The Democrats, run by the labor folks, do not want a bunch of legal workers coming into the United States.
Right.
So the Democrats and the Republicans agree in Congress that we need to leave this problem just like it is, among other things.
Which is not going to fix anything.
But here's the key. Now that the Republicans are going to have both houses,
mm-hmm.
they can't pass a bill in the House and have it ignored in the Senate. They're going to have to come up with something.
Yeah, their immigration reform has to happen.
If you want to take advantage of this election and do something positive, contact your senators and your congressmen and say, let's stop this mass of people pouring across the border. Now, last time I contacted John Carter, he said, well, the Senate won't allow the bill to even get past them because the Democrats control the Senate.
Well, that's not the case anymore.
And so let's give it to the president let's do immigration reform, let's have work permits, let's have guest workers.
Yeah, this is an area where I think John Carter is uniquely situated to have an influence. His wife is not originally an American citizen. Mm-hmm. She became one. And he went through that torture process. And by that, I know a lot of people who have married overseas and come back to the country. And one for 6 months unable to have their spouse come with them because they needed to wait for the whole permitting process, which is intensely expensive and time-consuming and bureaucratic. Then when the spouse finally gets here, the citizenship is not you got married for citizenship. No, that's a 10 to 15-year process. Well, if somebody's coming to work, it's even harder unless they have family here. And even then, you're talking about years.
Mm-hmm.
If our economy is teetering and we need nobody to come work, that's fine. That's not a problem. We're not doing anything bad. But when our economy is growing,
which is we're about to hit that point where we're going to start needing guest workers.
Right.
We've already hit that point.
We need people working in the fields. That's a temporary issue in that the fields, the harvesting of crops is going to be so mechanized in the future that there won't be no people involved. It will be done by drones. It will be big tractor drones and little tractor drones, and it will be flying drones, and it will be walking drones, and it will be rolling drones. There won't be people. We won't have to have unskilled labor there, but we will have to have skilled worker. We don't have enough people for the growth rate that we have.
But we also are going to continue to have people to make beds.
Oh, yeah.
Serve food.
The cooking of food is eventually going to be taken by robots, but not in the near future. Yeah, nowhere near.
So if you want to do something positive rather than just complaining about things, I would think we would barrage the secretary of the Conservative Caucus, our own Judge John Carter, and say, now that you've got control of both houses, let's pass a very clear bill to control the border. As a matter of fact, I had one of my clients make a recommendation to me, and I told him I'd mention it on the radio, so I will. He thinks we ought to bulldoze a 100-yard-wide stretch along the border and put fences and sensors all over it. Put fences on both sides, sensors on it, and a highway down the middle where when somebody crosses, we can pick them up immediately rather than allowing masses of people into the United States.
I have a little bit of issue with that.
Really?
Yeah. And it isn't the issue of danger. I recognize something has to be done. I have an issue, and it's a sentimental issue. When I look at the rest of the world.
Is that the 59%?
The 59%?
You said it was sentiment.
Oh, yeah. No, different kind of sentiment.
Oh, okay.
The rest of the world, if you go to a country and they have installed a wall.
It's to keep people in.
No.
It isn't?
Not in Israel.
Oh, well, maybe they got the right answer.
Well, except
if you notice, since they put the wall up, the number of suicide bombers blowing themselves up in Israel has dropped by 95%.
You're absolutely right. How many suicide bombers have we had come across the border from Mexico?
This is the point.
It might happen, and I recognize that there's a risk, but when you look at, you know, we just heard on the news break, Gorbachev, bring down this wall, tear down this wall.
Right.
If we're separating people who have families on both sides of the border.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about North Korea. We're talking about Berlin.
But listen to the other side of that. How many, and there's lots, of, and it's got to be two parts, this thing. Mm-hmm. One, let's control the border. Number two, let's have a guest worker program.
Correct.
And bring in enough people for our jobs legally. And the reason I say that, the number of people, there's nobody been able to keep very good records, but several college organizations have gone out to try to study this.
Right.
There are at least tens of thousands of people a year dying crossing that desert, and maybe as many as 100,000 people a year.
I wouldn't put it anywhere near that number, but well, there are people dying. There are a lot of people
dying. What they
did
is they've gone and done surveys of areas and found remains.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing that came out of the surveys they did is there's a lot more remains where people died out there than anybody thought there would be.
Basically what we have here, and this is the clearest way I can put it, is we have prohibition. We have the vast majority of Americans utilizing the services of illegal aliens. If you go to a restaurant, if you go to a hotel, if you live in a house, you've utilized the services of an illegal alien at some point, not directly, but some point in that process, you did. And it's keeping the prices low. We are not giving them the benefit of being able to come and do it legally, which is making the black market in immigration,
you and I agree,
in drug control, in terrorist-type possibilities going completely through the stratosphere. If we regulate it in a way that recognizes the need that we have as a country for immigration, for legally permitted people to work, we remove all of that.
And I completely agree with you. I do know that we already have fences up along a pretty good sized section of the border.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue of putting a wall up is already there.
Yep.
The bottom line to it is, though, how long is it going to be before some terrorist figures out? They're not real bright. Terrorists are not real bright to begin with.
They're not innovative. They tend to be the opposite.
How hard would it be for them to go to Mexico, where bribery is routine and dark skins are normal.
And come right across the border.
Come right across the border carrying a bomb.
Could happen.
And the point is,
just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't.
It's like saying that my house hasn't burned down yet.
You don't need insurance.
Therefore, I don't have to worry about anything.
You know,
right?
I intend to live forever.
You do?
I do. And so far, so good.
Good. Yes. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment, first of all, on the immigration thing. I think they really have to shut the borders right now because I think terrorists have already made their way through here, through that border. And then I wanted to comment about why the Republicans won. I think that they were blatant about putting their views out there. They were unapologetic as to what they believed in, and I believe the independents came around to our way of thinking and that we need more of it, and I don't think we should compromise too much on our principles, because I believe when you put conservative principles out there, they make sense.
Well,
and people are tired of the way the country has been going.
Agreed.
We had enough mm-hmm. of liberal views and
well,
ways
my
of doing
my
things,
suggestion
and I think that the country is ready for a change.
Okay, hang on. Listen to my side of this, okay?
Okay.
I think if you look at the percentage of people who voted, you'll discover something, and that is the vast, vast majority of the people who normally vote in presidential elections didn't vote this time. And
why is that?
They didn't vote because
they weren't inspired to.
They weren't inspired by the Republicans.
They weren't inspired by the Democrats.
And the president, very frankly, is one of the worst leaders as far as an actual leader. He's in my opinion, he's the worst leader we've had since Jimmy Carter.
I agree.
I agree with you.
And
there.
The point is, the next time around, somebody stands up and inspires the middle ground is going to win. And the fact that there was a landslide for Republicans this time, one of the biggest dangers the Republicans can draw from this is doing more of the same will win the next election.
Yeah. And one more piece. Let me throw this in. Ronald Reagan said, if I can find somebody that I can agree with 85% of the time, I'd run off a cliff for that candidate. If we as a group decide to stick to our principles so hard that last 15% is what we're waiting for, then the rest of the country is going to leave us. And it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. That's just the truth. I don't believe in compromising principles. But the Democrats, when Barack Obama won, when they took the House and the Senate, they said very clearly, this is a mandate from the people. The independents voted for us. They're coming around to our way of thinking. We just need to do more of it.
And
that's exactly what you just said. And we keep doing the swing back and forth. If we're not careful, if the Republicans aren't careful, if the Democrats aren't careful, what you get is just wider and wider swings.
Yeah. I'll just
tell
you this.
And the middle ground gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the Republican Party gets smaller, and the Democrat Party gets smaller, and that means that eventually another group is going to form, which is going to be the majority. That's scary.
At the next election, young people and Hispanics will be the deciding factors. In this election, it was old white people who were the deciding factor. If the Republicans do what we've heard Mitch McConnell and John Boehner say they want to do, if the Republicans will follow them and make some compromises where compromises are acceptable, to come to the middle a little bit, then we will probably see a Republican president and a Republican Congress.
Yeah, keep,
if they
keep
do
the words.
What you just said, which is hold harder to our principles, we are going to see something quite different. We're going to see the Democrats sweep next time.
Keep the words of Ronald Reagan in mind. Don't wait for a candidate that you completely agree with. Wait for a candidate that you agree with most of their stuff.
Yeah.
And if we try to make a platform that kicks people out because they don't agree 100%, then that's what this is part of the problem. And you can look at the numbers. The Republican Party is getting smaller.
Thanks.
Even though they won, it's
thanks
a smaller
calling.
Party.
Thanks for calling, okay?
Yes, thanks for the call.
The big danger for the Republicans is to do a George W. Bush and interpret this as a mandate.
Right.
The big opportunity
or Barack
for the
Obama,
Republicans,
for that matter, mandate interpretation, it seems to be a normal mistake.
Yeah, at this point is to appear to be mature and wise and bring the middle ground and consider what the middle ground people who didn't vote in this election are thinking and seeing. And that middle ground, by the way, is in with each election is increasingly younger people
and more educated people
and Hispanics. Those are the two biggest growth factors in the electorate. And very frankly, if the Republicans pull off a shift to the right, for example, first priority, my understanding of among that I've been listening to the noise from the Republicans, first priority is to simply repeal Obamacare.
That won't work.
If you repeal Obamacare, you will literally put tens of millions of people, you will take their health insurance away from them, slam bang. And when that happens,
that's not going to be an issue. That wasn't part of the platform that got them elected. That can't be part of their mandate because it wasn't what the vast majority of them ran on.
If they do a flat repeal, which is what a lot of Republicans are talking about, if they went in there and do a flat repeal,
boy, that would be bad.
You would instantly have tens of millions of people who literally are guaranteed to vote for anybody who's not a Republican.
Right. And that is a massive issue, that idea that we throw out the entire act. People that have listened to us for very long recognize that we look at the act as a hodgepodge full of sausage and problems, but also good stuff. There's good things, there's bad things. If you throw the whole thing out with nothing to replace it, the people that actually have experienced the good things here will be really upset, and people are a lot less likely to vote.
You will have people who have retired before age 65 who are well off, who got health insurance, who otherwise couldn't have health insurance, who suddenly have their health insurance yanked away from them. And if the Republicans take the credit for that, they are not going to find those people to be very friendly at the next election.
We've got commercials to run.
Oh, yes, we do. Okay. Well, so much for commercialism.
Yes. Let's get capitalism going again.
All right. We'll be back after these. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We will be back after these words from the people who pay for this radio station and show. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I don't know if anybody's listening from the station, but the next set of commercials is sort of messed up here. So if somebody from the station wanted to come in and straighten this stuff out, we're not going to be here for it, but it ought to be interesting. We were just talking during the break, Elon Musk's next mission, according to the Wall Street Journal.
He's one of the founders of PayPal. He sold it to eBay. He was also one of the founder of Tesla and SpaceX.
Yes, and
also does some solar power goodies.
He has lots of money, and he's the guy who is sponsoring the Lev train, maglev train between San Francisco and Los Angeles that'll go at hypersonic speeds or something.
That sounds like fun.
And anyway, he is, on November 7th, he made a announcement that he is going to focus on putting up about 700 satellites, each weighing less than 250 pounds. And he's going to put them in orbits similar to the way the GPS satellites are now, so that several of them are in view from any point on the Earth at any given moment.
For internet transmissions.
So that we will no longer have internet dead spaces on the planet anywhere, which I think will be, frankly, one of the largest cultural and technological changes in the history of the world. And I don't say that lightly. This is important. This is one of those things where everything changes after this. It's like Gutenberg's printing press or...
Yeah.
Only things are happening a lot faster. Let's presume he does this, and I let me tell you, when he first said, hey, we're going to be a commercially viable space company, and I thought, nah. But they
have worked.
They have become. Now there's competition up there, even though, by the way, the one that blew up.
Which one? Several have.
Recently, a rocket that was supposed to supply the space station.
Yeah, that was not SpaceX.
It wasn't SpaceX, but actually SpaceX is coming out ahead because of that one.
Yeah.
Apparently, that company, the engines they were using, one of which failed.
Russian designs.
Old Russian designs.
Yeah.
They bought a warehouse full of Russian engines, which was, in my humble opinion, a really bad idea.
Probably not the best way of doing it.
They don't exactly have the highest quality manufacturing standards back then.
SpaceX did
have
a rocket.
Soviet engines.
Yeah. Now, SpaceX did have a rocket blow up just a few months back. So that's not saying that SpaceX has the best technology. I think they do have the best technology, but you can't really find it based on blow ups. Right now, it's an equal.
Yeah.
Now,
equal opportunity blow ups.
Virgin Galactic just had a blow up, too, and there was a person involved. This is the second set of fatalities for Virgin. And it's difficult. We are talking about sitting on top of a very large amount of explosives.
This is the issue here is that these entrepreneurs, these billionaire entrepreneurs gathering other billionaires together, as a result, by the way, of this concentration of wealth, which is frowned upon, have actually made space flight and putting satellites in orbit a successful non-governmental enterprise. Now, here is my point. The reason space-based internet has not worked to date is it's done off of geosynchronous satellites.
That's a long ways up there.
22,300 miles or something up there. And as a result, there is a low bandwidth and a big lag.
Yeah, and a lot of drop packets.
If we can have a relatively low orbit 700 satellite network up there, it'll take the internet from slow motion horse and buggy to high speed maglev train speeds everywhere on the planet, so that wherever you go, like right now, if your GPS doesn't work as well as you, at least I would like it to work, it would suddenly start working better. You could literally get movies from everywhere. It will put, in my opinion, the ground-based communication companies in a world of hurt.
It's going to make mapping for just about anything a lot easier. If you think of when you're using your cell phone, the cell phone towers around you can get a pretty good two-dimensional location for where you are. They triangulate with each other, and they find, okay, well, there's two towers involved. That's where they are. That's when the government's looking for where people are, when AT&T says they have metadata.
That is notoriously inaccurate.
Correct. If you're talking about a network that's in three-dimensional space that has multiple points of measurement, we will be able to map the world in a way that is completely impossible, right? Not possible right now. It's a two-dimensional.
I like impossible. That's a new word. You and George W. should get together.
It will be possible, which is, you know, impossible means it's not ever going to be possible.
You don't want to miss
impossible is what really we're talking about. When we can map a mountain pass based on your driving with your cell phone or with your whatever it is that will replace that, because it will be a computer type something that may or may not be in a handheld, it may be part of your clothing, and maybe there's so many unknowns at this point that the whole future is open. We will be able to pinpoint things all over the world, and
including little boxes that are carried by small helicopters.
Yeah, and what is important here is that the ability for Google to drive a car with a computer just went way up. The ability for flying cars to take us places off the road just went way up because of that three-dimensional locality, the ability to find where you are. It's not just, oh, I can watch a movie faster. It is every aspect of our life, every aspect of logistics for bringing things to manufacturing, to sale, changes completely.
This is, I can't even, and I tried to use my imagination to think about all the societal changes that will come.
No, it's too big.
And it's 20 years from now, we will live in a world unrecognizable by a person who lives today. I'll just tell you that.
We are about out of time. Thanks for listening, if you have been listening. If not, then you can't hear me say, "Don't." No thanks to you.
Ha!
But if you'd like to contact us off the air, there's voicemail waiting over the weekend locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts sitting there. So if you were not insane enough from listening to us live, you can listen to us recorded.
Dead.
Yes, you can also send us emails through the site or directly Jake at TPWC.com or Jeff at TPWC.com. And we are looking forward to next week speaking to you again. And until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.